You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the continent to bring you the truth about cannabis and marijuana law reform.
I smoke pot and I like it a lot.
The Rough Belleville Show, the voice of the marijuana nation. Now, here's your host, Radical Russ Belleville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes, and welcome to the show. It is Thursday, December 4th, 2014, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Glad you could make it. Thank you for being there in the chat room. If you're there, if you're listening to us on TuneIn, you can always find us at 420radio.org, and our live chat window will be right there. You can join in the conversation, get your questions, suggestions, comments heard right here on the Voice of the Marijuana Nation. Got all sorts of interesting things to talk about on today's show, including our regular every other Thursday segment, Cops Say Legalize Drugs. And folks, today's Leap guest couldn't be more perfectly timed. We're speaking with former Maryland State Captain Lee Maddox. She was in the state police, and as part of her career, she went undercover and infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan. So, given the events regarding policing in America of the past 2 weeks, I think she'd be a very interesting guest to speak to. So stay tuned for that. Half past, we'll be speaking to Lee Maddox in Cops Say Legalize Drugs. We're also going to talk at the end of the show, have time for a little bit of a radical rant that might get a little bit off the warpath as well. I want to discuss the incident in New York City where the grand jury refused to indict the police officer who was shown on video choking to death an asthmatic man named Eric Garner. We're going to talk about that and how it is a race problem in this country. We've covered a lot about the war on drugs and the police state and militarization of the police. And if you can't see that this has all been fostered in the name of racism in this country, then I'm going to explain to you exactly how you need to see that, because it's become pretty glaringly obvious over these past couple of weeks. Also on the show, in Behind the Headlines, we're going to talk a little bit about why Eric Garner was out front of the convenience store selling loose, untaxed cigarettes, and how high cigarette taxes in New York City helped bring on the death of Eric Garner. We'll also have some time to get into the drug war data mines, and we'll do our 420 radio news. And in the headlines today, we've got another judge in Washington State saying dispensary bans are legal. We've got growers that are organizing in Oregon for the upcoming legalization regulation push in the legislature. We've got a state senator from Georgia who is presenting a marijuana legalization bill in Georgia. We've got the District of Columbia still looking at potentially banning their initiative for legalization through the Congress. And meanwhile, the DC City Council passing a pro-marijuana law. We'll talk about that as well. And an update from the case in Michigan where the police officers were busted for using medical marijuana butter. We've got the latest sentence for one of those officers and a short look at what's the latest in Miley Cyrus's career, as if we're all interested. We'll take a look at that and more in the 420 Radio News coming up right after the first break. And then hour two is Toker Talk Radio, where we take your calls at 971-533-7111. We also take a break at 420 with our daily Toker Tunes. And today, it's Groovin' Thursday. So Chuck Diesel will be calling in with some cool hip-hop for us to chill out as we await the 5 o'clock hour and the Big Daddy Fink Funky Roller Rink show with an hour of solid R&B for you. It's all coming up on 420radio.org. I'm Radical Russ with the Russ Belleville Show. Stay tuned. The news is next.
Voice of the Marijuana Nation.
420 Radio, the activist radio station.
Hey, this is Willie Nelson for Norman. And I smoke pot and I like it a lot. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer than alcohol. There's nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting those who smoke marijuana responsibly. To learn what you can do to help, contact Normal at NORML.org or call toll-free 888-67-NORMAL.
420radio.org is proud to replay Drug Policy Facts with Doug McVeigh from Portland, Oregon. Hosted by the editor of Drug War Facts, this show is a wealth of information for seekers of truth in the drug policy debates. Catch the replays Friday at 11 Pacific on 420radio.org. Five of the last nine major party candidates to run for president, three of the last nine vice presidential candidates, and the last three two-term presidents have all smoked pot. Marijuana, the gateway drug to the White House. This is the Russ Belville Show. It's time for the 420 Radio News, covering the latest headlines in consumer cannabis, medical marijuana, and industrial hemp. Transcripts of 420 Radio News are available daily on our website at 420radio.org. Now, here's Russ Belville with your marijuana headlines in 4 minutes and 20 seconds. This is your 420 Radio News for Thursday, December 4th, 2014. A fourth Washington state judge says cities and counties can ban licensed marijuana businesses within their jurisdictions. The state attorney general's office says Cowlitz County Superior Court Judge Michael Evans issued his ruling Wednesday in a case brought against neighboring Clark County. The plaintiffs, Emerald Enterprises LLC and John M. Larson, had argued that Washington's legal pot law did not leave room for such local bans. But the judge disagreed, joining judges in Benton, Chelan, and Pierce counties. The rulings comport with a legal analysis issued by Attorney General Bob Ferguson earlier this year, in which he said nothing in Washington's legal pot law explicitly overruled local zoning authority. The plaintiffs in the Pierce County case have appealed to the state Supreme Court, which has not announced whether it will accept the case. Early Wednesday, about 30 medical marijuana growers and cannabis concentrate producers crowded into the U.S. Bancorp Tower with a view of the Willamette River to talk shop and policy. The group included cannabis producers from across the state, including outdoor marijuana growers from Southern Oregon. The group, formed by Portland criminal defense lawyer Amy Margolis, is part of the Oregon Growers PAC, a political action committee formed to influence statewide marijuana policy. Among the topics the group discussed Wednesday are marijuana testing, mainstreaming by working with local politicians through fundraising and lobbying, and the importance of the Oregon Growers PAC to put forth professional, well-spoken representatives. State Senator Kurt Thompson, a Democrat from DeKalb County, has filed a bill that would legalize recreational marijuana in Georgia, much like Colorado's law. Thompson says the additional revenue raised would go towards transportation infrastructure and education if it were to pass in Georgia. But while Senator Thompson wants the marijuana discussion to include recreational use, Republican lawmakers are determined to keep the discussion centered on medical CBD use only. Quote, "I will fight with as much energy and compassion and conviction to make sure we don't have recreational use of marijuana in our state," end quote, said State Representative Alan Peek, the Republican state representative spearheading Georgia's effort to legalize medical marijuana. He made it clear his bill will not lead the state toward legalizing recreational marijuana. An amendment blocking the legalization of marijuana in the District of Columbia is on the table as appropriators negotiate bills and policy riders to incorporate in the year-end spending package. The issue remained unsettled on Wednesday and has been forwarded to the chair and ranking members of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees. If enacted, the amendment would reverse the decriminalization of marijuana, which took effect this summer, and block an attempt to legalize the drug in the district. In November, D.C. voters overwhelmingly voted for the legalization measure. A policy manager for the Drug Policy Alliance has said that conversations with rank-and-file Republicans and leadership's reluctance to take a hardline stance on legalization in the past indicate GOP leaders will not push for the rider to be included. The D.C. Council unanimously passed temporary legislation yesterday that will prohibit an employer from drug testing potential employees for marijuana before a conditional job offer has been made. The bill, the Prohibition of Pre-Employment Marijuana Testing Emergency Act of 2014, was introduced by Councilmember Vincent Orange in March of this year and explicitly states that an employer cannot test a potential employee for marijuana use until after an offer for employment has been made. After an employee has been hired, however, they, quote, must still adhere to the workplace policies set forth by their employer, end quote. The surviving corrections officer who pleaded guilty to charges related to the discovery of marijuana butter at his home will not face jail, but must pay a $10,000 fine and potentially testify against two other officers. Brian Tennant, a 20-year veteran of the Kent County Sheriff's Department in Michigan, told a judge Thursday that he never meant to break the law. Quote, I pick up prescriptions for my wife, end quote, Tennant told Kent County Circuit Judge Dennis Lieber. Quote, I believed I was operating within the law, end quote. Police say Tennant's wife, Christine, was a medical marijuana patient under the caregiving of Timothy Scherzer. The other officer facing felony charges over the marijuana butter, Tim Bernhardt, committed suicide last week. Miley Cyrus was caught smoking pot on stage in her latest concert. Quote, usually I don't smoke weed and drink. Well, that's a lie. Usually I don't smoke weed and drink on show days, but I felt like it was fine in Miami, end quote, said Cyrus. This has been your 420 Radio News for Thursday, December 4th, 2014. I'm Russ Belville. 420 Radio, the home of marijuana experts.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
The Russ Belville Show reminds you to never smoke and drive impaired. Hang out for a while. Share.
NORMAL stands for Responsible Adult Cannabis Use. If cannabis use is causing problems in your life, consider taking a break or seeking medical assistance. Consider ceasing cannabis use if you have a family history of mental illness. Don't drive or operate heavy machinery while impaired by cannabis use. Cannabis use is not without risks, even though the risks are far less than those posed by legal drugs.
There's so much I worry about as a mom. Stephen Harper thinks that organized crime should continue to profit from marijuana prohibition. Imagine regulating marijuana like alcohol and cigarettes with a strong and clear educational message, making it more difficult for my kids and your kids to access. Drug dealers don't ask for ID. Stephen Harper does not have the kind of judgment we need to protect our children, authorized by the Normal Women's Alliance of Canada.
Welcome back, everybody. 13 after the hour, and today in Behind the Headlines, I wanted to take a look at a piece that was just published in New York Magazine. It's entitled, Your Grandmother's Guide to Pot. Now, as these kind of articles go, it's a pretty decent primer on the state of marijuana in America for someone who may have been out of the loop for a while or just now learning about it. It's not a bad piece as far as that goes. But I do have one major problem with it, and that it repeats that hoary myth that today's marijuana is not your father's Woodstock weed. Ooh. Please, media, stop propagating this myth that the 1960s weed was 1% THC, or that the 1990s weed was 3% THC. Does anybody really believe that Cheech and Chong were smoking 1% THC joints? Does anybody really believe when they were sipping on gin and juice that Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre were firing up 3% THC blunts? Now, it's not really the media's fault. They might not know too much about the science behind this, and the way they get this Woodstock weed myth is they refer to the federal government's figures on average THC potency in seized marijuana. This all comes from the University of Mississippi's Potency Monitoring Project, and those numbers are a joke. Here's what's wrong with them. First of all, THC wasn't even discovered until 1964 by Dr. Raphael Meshulam in Israel. So any report on what THC percentages were in the 1960s in the United States of America are bogus. In fact, when they did those first cannabis seizures and they did the first THC testing, they were testing cannabis that had been sitting in hot, dry lockers for weeks or months before it was tested. And naturally, the THC potency degrades over time, given heat. Second, the DEA has changed how it submits its samples of seized marijuana. Now, throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they were just rounding up all the marijuana they could find, indoor, outdoor, whatever, cultivated pot, hydroponic, whatever it was, as well as the wildly growing feral hemp that's left all over the Midwest still, you know, in Nebraska, Kansas. We often call it ditchweed. And they would take all this marijuana and grind it all up, stem, stalk, seeds, leaves, and buds, and then take the average THC of that. Yeah, now, with that, sure, you might get 2 to 4% THC, but nobody was smoking the stalks and the leaves and the seeds. They were smoking those buds, which back then were testing out at 8 to 12%. Third, most marijuana cultivation moved indoors in the 1990s and 2000s through lower-cost technologies, lights, hydroponics. We learned how to control the light cycle of the plant to induce it to produce more THC. We started crossbreeding strains for potency. And yeah, the growers were able to raise the THC level of the buds up to 15%, 20%. But when the government was doing their seizures back in the 90s and 2000s, they were still including outdoor weed. They were still including Mexican brickweed imports. And so, yeah, the average moved up to about 7 or 10%. And then fourth, as we perfected indoor growing here in America, and as we loosened our laws through medical marijuana and now legalization, fewer people are importing and smoking Mexican brickweed. And the DEA stopped including ditchweed in its eradication totals. So nowadays, what gets tested for average THC is largely indoor-grown, well-manicured buds that, yes, some of them now exceed 20 to 25% THC. So yeah, marijuana potency has increased, but it's not 10 times more potent or 20 times more potent. Maybe it's 2 or 3 times more potent, you know, based on the buds that make up the part of marijuana that people actually smoke. But it is wrong and unfair to compare the seed, stem, stalks, leaves, brickweed, and ditchweed from the 60s to the finely manicured medical marijuana of today and claim somehow potency's gone up 20 times. But you know what? The potency of marijuana doesn't matter anyway because THC is non-toxic. Now, if you drink tequila in the same amount and frequency you drink beer, that's a problem. Because alcohol is toxic, and while a six-pack of beer might get you buzzed, 72 ounces of tequila might make you die. But if you smoke a modern joint in the same amount and frequency as you did at Woodstock, you just get high. Really high. But you won't smoke that modern joint the same way you smoked the joint at Woodstock, because marijuana smoking is self-titrating. You feel the effects immediately, and you stop when you feel high. Alcohol's not like that. You might get 6 shots of tequila into you before you realize you should have stopped at 3, because it takes some time for your stomach and liver to process the alcohol. In other words, high is a destination, and it doesn't matter whether you take the bicycle of a Woodstock joint to get there, or you take the bullet train of a modern joint to get there, you still get to the same place, high. In fact, you can smoke less of today's marijuana to get high, but it's still the same high you could have gotten to with more weak marijuana. If anything, the media should be thanking cannabis growers for making a way to get high with less smoking required. And of course, the media always is focusing on the marijuana smoking and pays little attention to the fact that we have marijuana vaporization now. So not only is the marijuana more potent and we need less smoke, we can actually eliminate all the smoke through vaporization technologies. And yet the only stories you get in the media about vaporization are when the governments are trying to ban vaping in certain spaces. Or a scare story about how kids are using vape pens to sneak marijuana into school. Media, get the facts right. It's too late in the game to be this reefer mad. All right, well, 20 after the hour, 4:20 in Denver, Colorado, which means it's probably past 4:20 in Texas. And I hope my dear friend in Texas, who I pissed off today, is getting over it. I mean no harm. We're just arguing, man. No need to take it so personally. It's okay to disagree and still be friends. Back after this. 420 Radio, fighting prohibition since 2012. Hey tokers and tokettes, Radical Russ here for the Canador, a practical solution to keep herbs from drying. The Canador is the perfect airtight storage system for your fine herbs. From the half-inch thick walnut and cherry wood construction, clear-top perforated jars for storage, and the humidity bead system that keeps your herbs at a perfect 65% relative humidity. I keep all my herbs in the Canador, and you should too. Check out Canador.com for more information.
Hello.
Hello.
I am John.
I'm Scott.
We're from a cannabis broadcast.
And you are listening to 420radio.org.
Cheers.
Get .buzz. .buzz is the internet platform that fuels community interest, excitement, and new experiences. .buzz is the premier online destination for internet users seeking the latest news on a variety of topics. .buzz appeals to groups active in blogging, communications, journalism, advertising, and marketing. .buzz offers registrants a stronger alternative to the shrinking namespace of existing top-level domain names, such as .com, .net, and .org. Get your name now at get.buzz. Arguing for the end of adult marijuana prohibition is easy because we have facts, science, reason, compassion, evidence, truth, and logic on our side. It is even easier when researchers catalog it all for us. Learn how to gather the facts on marijuana use, arrests, seizures, rehabs, drug tests, and more in this edition of Drug War Data Mining. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Drug War Data Mine. And of course, on my mind and on a lot of people's minds lately is the death of Eric Garner, the man who was killed by a New York police officer using a prohibited chokehold. The man died of suffocation. It was ruled a homicide, and we have video of the guy that killed him, but there's no charges being brought. And we'll discuss that a little bit later in the radical rant. But right now I wanted to focus on part of what helped to kill Eric Garner. And that is overtaxation. We are talking about cigarettes here. What Eric Garner was alleged to have been doing out front of that convenience store is selling what are called loosies. Loosies just means loose cigarettes, right? This is when someone takes a pack of cigarettes and they sell them, you know, one at a time. Right. And the problem, of course, is that, you know, gets around cigarette taxes. It allows somebody to make a black market living. Basically, he got busted. He was being investigated for being an illegal cigarette dealer. Now, that kind of shocked me because where I'm from, Idaho, and most of the smokers I know, I could have never found anyone who would want to buy a single cigarette. In fact, it's very common among the smokers I know to say, hey man, you got a cig? Can I bum a cig? And people just give them away. So it was weird to me to try to wrap my mind around the idea of buying a single cigarette until I took a look at this website. This is a website, this is the International Business Times, and it put together a color-coded interactive map of cigarette taxation and price throughout the United States. Now, as you're looking at this map, the darker red a state is, the higher their state tax on cigarettes is, from a low of 17 cents a pack to a high of $4.35 a pack. Now, this can have greatly disparate impacts on the price of the cigarettes. My home state is Idaho. Clicking on Idaho tells us that a pack of cigarettes costs about $5.25, and the excise tax is 57 cents on a pack. So, not much profit in trying to sell them individually. If a pack's $5, there's 20 to a pack. What are you talking about there? 25 cents a cigarette? So, you know, not much money that you could make on that. But just across the border here in Oregon, a pack of cigarettes is 10 cents more. The excise tax is $1.31. But in Washington state, they have very, very high cigarette taxes, as I'm told by my tobacco-smoking friends. And there, the tax on cigarettes is $3.03 a pack. A pack of smokes costs $8.32. So clearly, someone here on the border between Idaho and Washington could make a whole bunch of money buying cigarettes for $5.25 and selling them at $8.32. There's $3 worth of profit in there. $3 worth of difference. Now, New York City specifically, where Eric Garner was killed. In New York, a pack of cigarettes costs $14.50. I can damn near get three packs of cigarettes in Idaho for what it costs to get a pack of cigarettes in New York. By comparison, you take a state like Kentucky, a pack of cigarettes is less than $5. In North Carolina and Virginia, a pack of cigarettes is close to $6. That presents an entirely different circumstance, and these two places are not that far apart. In fact, it is quite lucrative to drive down there to Virginia, or maybe North Carolina, $5.14 a pack in North Carolina, load up a van full of smokes, and take it back up there to New York, where you can sell them at $14.50 a pack. Even if you undercut that tax by $4 and sell them at $10 a pack, you're still making an incredible profit. It is long past time for us to stop trying to use taxation as a means of controlling the morality and what vices our citizens might choose to engage in. I am all for regulation. I'm all for taxation to the point where it keeps the product safe and pays for the regulation. But any taxes above what it costs in social costs, in healthcare costs, those are punitive taxes, those are sin taxes, and they can only lead to sinful behavior. In this case, the murder of a man who was trying to sell a few loose cigarettes. 420 Radio, your ticket to the Boston Freedom Rally. Are you a hypocrite? If you live a closeted cannabis lifestyle, you are. Read about seven people living a closeted cannabis lifestyle who are on the verge of coming out in The Hypocrites by Mara K. Eaton. Available at areyouahypocrite.net. You can purchase the book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, also available on iTunes. Check out Mara K. Eaton on Facebook as well. Learn more at areyouahypocrite.net.
Despite strong public support for medical cannabis, decriminalization and legalization in Georgia, the state spends $121 million every year to arrest, prosecute, and imprison Georgians for simple possession. Each year, the state of Georgia spends less on driver services, agriculture, and forestry combined. What else can $121 million a year do in Georgia? With that much money, the state could hire and keep 3,000 more teachers, improve roads and bridges, provide tax relief for small businesses, repair aging sewage systems, or lower taxes. But right now, that's millions of dollars of your tax money wasted on failed enforcement. Tell your representative you're tired of wasteful spending and ask them to end cannabis prohibition. Join the conversation at www.peachtreenormal.org. Peachtree Normal is a proud affiliate of Normal, the national organization for the reform of marijuana laws.
Growing plants indoors can be a rewarding hobby, but electricity bills can go through the roof. Then you have to cool down all those big hot lights. It can drive a grower insane. With Lush LED lighting, you can solve many of these issues and double your rewards. Matt and his scientists have developed the perfect light for flowering plants with far less cost and heat. And the results? Very effective. Check out LushLEDLighting.com right now and tell them Radical Russ sent you.
Whoa. One of the most disturbing elements of the Prohibition War is how it's made police the enemy of otherwise law-abiding cannabis consumers. Fortunately, one group of police officers knows the futility of Prohibition and reaches out to educate the community and current law enforcement. Today, the Russ Belville Show visits with another speaker from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition with one clear message. Cops say legalize drugs.
Welcome back, everyone. Half past, and joining us by telephone, we've got Lee Maddox from Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Lee, welcome to the show. Hello, Lee, do we have you? Oh, let's see if we can get Lee back on the phone. She was just on the line there, and looks like she just dropped off. May have been unsure of how we were connecting, but we'll make sure we get her on the line. Of course, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, you can find them at leap.cc, and they are the leading law enforcement organization speaking out against the war on drugs in all its facets. Lee, do we have you on the line?
You do. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Lee. Thanks for joining us here on the show. I'm so glad you're here today. I'm just looking at your bio, and I see that you're a former special assistant state attorney and a retired state police captain. You worked as a patrol trooper, as a supervisor. You worked undercover infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan, and then you were a coordinator for the racial profiling consent decree in Baltimore, I believe. I couldn't have picked a better guest to have on, given the events of the past couple of weeks, and I was wondering if maybe you could speak to us from your experience and what you see going down in the growing awareness of police militarization and abuse of citizens.
Yeah, so thanks for having me on, and I'm happy to be here. My career was fascinating, and everything you described, guilty as charged, did all that and a little bit more, but seeing things unfold through the eyes of the community in Ferguson and how that's played out nationwide and sort of shifting the dialogue and raising awareness about police militarization and how scary that really is, you kind of tease that out to the long term. It's all very, very problematic. And I view this actually as a wonderful opportunity to engage, and I hope that this moment doesn't slip by like it has so many times previously.
Yeah. And I know that, we like to, in drug policy reform, we look at this and we see it through the drug war lens. I see a whole bunch of correlations and how the drug war has led to this militarization and this treatment of citizens as, you know, the occupied country rather than, you know, protect and serve the citizens kind of situation. But I am curious about something. In the protests that we've seen in Ferguson, now in New York over Eric Garner, one of the chants that comes up is no justice, no peace, no racist police. Is there an element of racism in our police, either in our structures or in some of the people that are choosing to become police officers? Or is this really more systemic than it is personal?
So I struggled with this for years because my department was accused back in the early 1990s of racial profiling. And I worked with those brave men and women, and I thought, you know, they're not racist. I talk to them every day. They're not. But the more I got into the background and got to see the systems and the systemic collateral consequences that flow from just a simple marijuana arrest, that's when I saw, okay, now it's not explicit bias. It's implicit bias plus a systemic problem that sets people up for failure.
You know, there's a hashtag that's trending on social media right now, criming while white. And it's in response to this where white folks have been putting up in Twitter the crimes they committed and how leniently they were treated by police officers when they committed those crimes, when the implication would be if a black person did the same thing, they'd have been arrested, thrown down, handcuffed, all of that. Did you see anything like that in your career where there was a very disparate treatment of subjects by race?
I didn't necessarily see that during my career, but I have witnessed the stories that have come out of my clients in Baltimore City, and trust me, there. And you can read the reports from the ACLU, if I know you have, and there's definitely a desperate impact that has occurred. You know, the question is, why has that occurred? And I think a lot of it, quite frankly, goes right back to our hiring practices. I mean, like here in Maryland, you can't be hired if you've ever been arrested for anything, pretty much. You can't be hired if you've used marijuana more than X times. You can't be hired if you've used cocaine more than, what, maybe once. You can't be hired if you ever used LSD or mushrooms or PCP. And so well, you know, we're hiring choir boys, essentially, and a lot of them are Vietnam vets, or not Vietnam vets, but vets who have other ancillary, you know, PTSD issues they bring to the game. And that whole, you know, kind of pot that we're mixing it all up in is just creating not such a good relationship between the police and the community, because the police, quite frankly, don't represent the community.
And of course, like I mentioned earlier, I see a lot of this through a drug war lens, and I see how, you know, the mass incarceration pretty much started around the same time Nixon said, go after the hippies. And there's so much of the drug war that's entrenched in this. But do you see the drug war as just a tool that further exacerbates an already broken system? Or is the drug war itself, you know, if we fix that, it's going to fix a large part of the system?
So both, but I think I tend to go with the latter. I think that if we can figure our way out of this drug war maze, that I think that the rest of the stuff will be more manageable. I think it's going to take probably about 60% of the work out of the federal and state and municipalities if done correctly. And that will give those employees more time to focus on the stuff that we really should be caring about, like, you know, putting murderers away, and, you know.
Maybe,
you know,
a Wall Street banker or two. we're speaking with Lee Maddox. He's a retired captain from the Maryland State Police and a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. They have a great stable of fantastic speakers who can speak with gravitas toward the issue of ending the war on drugs. You can find out more at leap.cc. Now, Lee, I'd also like to ask about policing the police. I think one of the things that's gotten people really upset, and more so in this Eric Garner case, since there's videotape, is where we seem to see that just about any action by a police officer against a subject can be excused through the grand jury process and through a feeling of, well, the police thought they were threatened and they thought they were, you know, in danger. What sort of changes are we going to have to implement to see better policing of the police?
Well, one, I think we need to, again, go back to our hiring standards, and we need to start hiring people that are actually connected to the community and not from different areas. Two, training is tremendously important. We need to keep training officers and bring the community into the training so that there can be some sort of relationship on the front end. And then, gosh, you know, it's a hard nut to crack. The divide is so big. I struggle with how are we ever going to write it. You know, in Baltimore, we're talking a lot about body cameras, you know, yet another layer of technology. Is that going to actually make things more transparent? Or, you know, even though there's a video, you know, is the grand jury still not going to indict? And that's a really scary thing, because grand juries are secret, and they're very different than the jury of your peers. That's a public sort of venue. It's very troubling.
Yeah, I can't understand why there isn't, you know, in a situation where the state kills a citizen, there should automatically be a trial. I don't even see how that we even have a decision as whether there should be one. This is the state killing a citizen. I think that's the most serious thing. Let me ask you about another angle on this, and this is the militarization of the police. This came to most people's attention through the Ferguson protests, but those of us in the drug war, this is like old hat to us. We recognized this for a long time ago. And in response to this, President Obama said, you know, pretty much indicated that we're not going to change the program. We're still going to get this stuff to the cops, this military gear, but they might have to fill out more paperwork and have a little more oversight. Doesn't that seem like it's kind of ignoring what the real problem is, and that is equipping our police like a military force?
Yes, it does. And, you know, not too very long ago, just before Ferguson broke, I had some friends over who are police chief, assistant police chief, just, you know, hanging out at the house, and they're like, Lee, man, you know, the state wants to give us this equivalent of a tank, right? And it's a very small police department. I was like, well, what are you going to do with it? He's like, well, we're going to spray paint our colors on it. I was like, yeah, but can't you just say no? Because, you know, they don't have the infrastructure to be able to maintain and train properly. And then, heaven forbid, you know, stuff hits the fan and you can't actually execute in a way that's respectful to the community. And we saw that in Ferguson. I mean, oh, you know, everything after those first two shots, it was all just downhill.
Yeah. John Oliver did a fantastic segment showing one local police department, a small town police department, spinning wheelies in a military armored vehicle that they had just received through some of these drug war grants. And it seems these military grants, and it just seems so over the top to think that, you know, a place like Keene, New Hampshire needs to be prepared against, you know, terrorist attack and IEDs or something like that. Oh.
Exactly. And don't get me wrong. There is a place, you know, when we get big mall shootings or school shootings or, you know, mass sort of, you know, like the Boston Marathon, there is a place when police need to be, you know, present and engaged and there. Mm-hmm. But it's not the everyday, you know, we used to hide in the bunkers during the protests. We only came out when it got really bad. We would just kind of hunker down as police and let people, you know, speak and let them voice their objections. That's kind of embedded in our Constitution, and I hate to see us get away from that.
Yeah, it's such a shame. And a final question here, Lee, as we move forward and we're trying to address these issues between police and the citizenry, what would you suggest that the average listener out there, the average citizen, could do to help move this along?
Pay attention, read from multiple sources, make your own opinion, and engage your local politicians at every level.
There you go. Get involved, get engaged, let them know you're watching, let them know you care. Remember that you can film cops. It's perfectly legal as long as you're not interfering with them. And put a password on your cell phone. They need a warrant to get into it then. Lee Maddox is a retired captain from the Maryland State Police and a speaker for law enforcement against prohibition. Any final thoughts, Lee, before we go?
Just thank you, Radical Russ. It's great to be on your show.
Oh, thank you, Lee. We'll get to meet in person someday soon, I'm sure.
No, we did. We met in Portland, Patients Out of Time.
That's right, Patients Out of Time Conference.
At the Cannabis Cafe, remember? That was a blast.
Well, I have trouble sometimes remembering what happened at the Cannabis Cafe. I don't know why. Thanks, Lee, so much for joining us. All right. When we come back, we're going to have a radical rant taking a look at this same subject. And I'm going to show you that, yes, folks, it's a race problem. We can't not talk about it anymore. It really exists. Stay tuned.
Of the Marijuana Nation.
420 Radio, freeing your mind 24 hours a day.
You know Herb Thrasher from the Herb Thrasher Flower Hour. Now get ready for Herb Age Designs for the proud cannabis consumer. Herb Age Designs, lifestyle gear for the 420 friendly. Herb Age Designs, we've got frisbee golf discs and durable hemp gear. Herb Age Designs. We've got shot glasses, drinking glasses, coffee mugs, and beer cozies. Check us out on Facebook and online at herbagedesigns.com. And follow Herb Age and Herb Thrasher on Twitter.
In the interest of fair and balanced journalism, the Russ Belville Show presents the anti-drug public service announcement of the day.
When I grow up, I want to be a track star.
No one ever says, I want to be a junkie when I grow up.
Well, I want to be a ballerina.
Yet thousands of kids let getting high make a mess of their lives.
I want to be a nurse.
Don't let drugs get in the way of your dreams.
This has been the anti-drug public service announcement of the day. To cure this sort of reefer madness, listen to the Russ Belville Show every weekday on 420radio.org. Adam Hand of Handmade Apparel produces quality custom designs for t-shirts, hats, and other apparel. Handmade Apparel is the official design shop for 420 Radio, among many clients who rely on Adam Hand for everything from short-run custom projects to full-run clothing lines. Visit handmadeapparel.biz to browse the selection of handmade gear or to get a personal quote for your own designs. Handmade Apparel, a proud supporter of 420radio.org.
You can't handle the truth. The
entirely legitimate topic for debate.
You have offended my family.
Hey, this is great, man.
And you have offended a Shaolin temple.
One major responsibility is to encourage people to use less drugs.
I know nothing.
I support a change in law. In federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
We don't need no stinking budget.
Homosexuality, immorality in general.
How in the century you have slurred the meaning of the words we, the people.
Be warned, this is not your mother's marijuana.
You could ask yourself a question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
I want to ask you a bunch of questions. I want to have them answered immediately.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Radical Rant.
Welcome back, everybody. 46 after the hour. And I've got to talk about this no indictment in the case of Eric Garner in New York, the latest unarmed black man to be killed by police and have grand jury not indict for anything. Not murder, not manslaughter, not involuntary, not accidental, no nothing. You got a situation here where Eric Garner is seen on videotape being choked to death by the cops, where the coroner reports it as a homicide. And there's no charges against anyone except the guy who filmed it. Have you heard this? Yeah, no indictment for the guy, the cop, who chokeholded this guy. And by the way, a chokehold is a banned procedure in the New York Police Department. Used a banned procedure to choke a guy to death, no charges, on video. But the guy who videoed it, he was indicted and charged with a crime. Not at the time, but about a month later, the police claim that he had a gun and that he gave it to someone else before the cops were able to get to him. And he was indicted for that. And the cops that were busting this guy told them, or the guy said, you're just going after, I don't have nothing, you guys are going after me because I caught you, because I videotaped you killing Garner. And one of the cops, while busting the guy, said, yeah, karma's a real bitch, isn't it? That's the kind of police state we are living in right now. And I really, really wish the people in my Facebook feed, my Twitter feed, and just people in general, especially white folks like me, would just finally admit that we live in a racist country. I know, I'm your stereotypical cisgender, married, straight, white, middle-class, middle-aged, middleweight male. I'm as white privilege as it comes. I'm as lily white as you can be in this country. But I have some understanding of what's going on here. I've got black family. I've got black nieces and nephews. I don't want my black nephew having to grow up and become a teenager and have his mom worry every time he leaves the house whether or not cops are going to kill him. My mom never had to worry about that. Me and my friends, my white friends in Nampa, Idaho, when we used to go out, mom and dad would be like, hey, see you later. Be home by sunrise. No worries about the crazy crap we were going to get into or whether we get killed for it. I grew up in a largely Hispanic, mostly Mexican immigrant neighborhood. Went to school, most all my friends, first generation Americans. The only fist fight I ever got into in grade school was over racism, was over a white bully picking on my Mexican friend, calling him a spick. Only fight I've ever been in. Only time I've ever laid, well, that's not true. The only time I wanted to lay hands on someone with the intent of violence. I wrote for a gay and lesbian blog. I was accredited at the 2008 Democratic National Convention to write on gay issues. That's right, Mr. Married Straight White Guy writing on gay issues. I've got friends who are disabled and had to deal with all of the things, you know, had to see all the things that they have to deal with. So I'm not trying to claim, yeah, I've got gay friends, I've got black friends, you know, so like I know everything or anything. I'm just trying to say that maybe I know more than some. And to add to all that, I'm a pot-smoking atheist. In fact, atheist is one of the few labels you can put on yourself that is going to get you more revulsion than almost any other label in this country. As far as like, would you vote for, would you be comfortable living next to, would you let your daughter marry a... So I guess the point that I want to get to is that too many of us in this country want to misdirect, redirect, and try to make this about anything other than race. I see people that post a link to the white kid that was shot in Salt Lake by the cops. Or there was a case in, I forget which state it was that popped up, where the black cop shot the white kid and he was not indicted. And nobody freaked out about that. Whenever these issues of race come up, sometimes it's just so uncomfortable for some people that they will go to any lengths to find any correlation, any tangent they can to say, well, no, it's not race. It's really about class. It's really about class. Really? You think it's about class? Talk to Henry Louis Gates. You know who he is? He is a black professor at Harvard who got the cops called on him because he was in his own house. Doesn't happen to the white professors at Harvard very often. Yes, class has something to do with it. If you're a toothless meth hillbilly in Kentucky, you might not get treated the best by cops either. But that's only a shell of what's going on over the core. And the core is that this country is racist at its core. Have you ever heard of the saying that the fruit of the poison tree? You hear this in the law a lot. Like if the cops do an illegal search, they can't then use the evidence from that illegal search because the evidence is the fruit of the poison tree, right? You already messed up by doing the illegal search. You can't use anything from that point on because it's illegal as well. It's the results of something illegal. Well, the fruit of the poison tree in America is what we're experiencing right now. We're a country that was built on the idea of slavery, that in our entire economy, our entire existence would not be without slavery. And through the 1800s, when most of the rest of the nations of the world were banning slavery, Britain did it decades before we did, we held on to it. We held on to it because our entire country was put together on a compromise. That's what it was called, the Three-Fifths Compromise. The northern states knew that the northern colonies knew that the southern colonies wouldn't go along in any sort of united front against the British Empire unless slavery was part of the deal, unless those southern states can continue their slavery. And to be fair, the northern states couldn't have gotten by without the slavery that was producing all of the industry in the South either. So our entire country is built on this compromise to allow the slavery and subjugation of an entire race of people. And some folks don't believe that still affects us. They like to think racism's a long ago thing. Oh, slavery's over. Well, yeah, what about Reconstruction era and lynchings? Yeah, but that was after the Civil War. Well, yeah, what about the Jim Crow laws and the different water fountains and the different schools? Yeah, but that ended in the 1950s. Well, what about the civil rights battles and the struggles to get the Civil Rights Act passed? Well, yeah, but that was in the 1960s. Folks, racism in this country did not end with Martin Luther King, and it did not end with the election of Barack Obama. The more you dig into this, the more you learn about the pernicious systemic racism in this country. Things like redlining. Do you know what redlining is? Redlining is when neighborhoods were divvied up. The real estate was divvied up into certain areas where black people could and could not get loans. Even black veterans from World War II or Vietnam, whatever, could not get loans for homes in certain areas, white areas. Concentrating all these people into poorer neighborhoods with less services, with less policing, with less fire protection, and so forth. And then we're surprised when these neighborhoods without much supervision or control or help or investment then became these urban inner city wastelands that they lament. And then the very people who brought those kind of tactics into play will point to the dysfunction in the inner city and blame it on the Democrats. They'll blame it on the liberals. Oh, see, the Democrats, everybody they vote for here is Democrat, and how awful their city is. See how bad Democrats are, without giving any lip service to the entire system that was built before that, that made the outcomes pretty much inevitable in those areas. Racism is not some long ago forgotten chapter of American history. There are black men alive today whose fathers were in the Tuskegee experiments. We experimented on black men from the 1930s through the 1970s by giving them syphilis on purpose and only treating half of them just to see what would happen to the other half. That stopped in the 70s, people. And then there's that special flavor of idiot who'll raise his head and complain about reverse racism. Oh, it's reverse racism now. Yeah, sure. Anybody out there complaining about reverse racism should be allowed to become black. By God, if it's so good for black people, you ought to be allowed to be black. That's what I think the people complaining about this reverse racism should feature. This is so systemic in our United States policy, from the people who were able to buy homes, white folks, who could then build that equity into personal wealth, build that personal wealth into businesses, and build those businesses into empires. But black folks, on the other hand, for generation after generation, who were promised 40 acres and a mule following emancipation, they were redlined out of neighborhoods, they were denied the same kind of loans, and they were treated differently in employment and hiring to never be able to build up that personal wealth and those personal businesses and empires to the same extent. You know, there was a interesting series of studies that I've taken a look at over this past week. One of them showed that when they took a resume, identical resumes, the same schools, the same experience down the line, and sent them out to thousands of recruiters and thousands of employers, but on half the resumes, they'd put a white name like Brendan or Chad. And on the other half of the resumes, they'd put a black name like Jamal or DeAndre. Guess which resumes got 50% more callbacks? Brendan and Chad. When you're working against a system that's already stacked against you, it's hard not to see the system is racist. Another study showed random sets of people, both white and black people, two different pictures. One picture, two white men, one with a knife. Another picture, a white man and a black man, one with a knife. Both white and black people misidentified the second set of pictures and more inaccurately placed the knife in the black man's hand when it wasn't there than they did in inaccurately determining which of the two white men held the knife. Even black people were more likely to figure that the black person was the criminal in the picture, even when they weren't. We'll talk more about this in hour two. For everyone here at 420 Radio, I'm Radical Russ. Until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com.
You take a seat, you plan it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seat, you plan it, you